From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com. Some people want to fight hate by censoring or even banning so-called hate speech. We'll speak with a prominent national civil liberties expert who recommends a different approach. A new North Carolina committee is studying the fair treatment of student-athletes at the state's public universities. You'll hear highlights from one of the group's first meetings. A top advocate for school choice in North Carolina has a new leader. You'll hear from the president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. He'll share his priority list. And we'll explain how millennials could drive major changes in the future of American health care. Their desire for on-demand services could threaten traditional healthcare models. Those topics are just ahead. But first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
A legislative committee investigator will be hired to determine who did what with regard to Governor Roy Cooper's $58 million fund, that fund attached to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline project. Legislators want to know if the governor's conduct was legal and also if there was pressure applied to the pipeline operators to agree to turn over funds during the permitting process for the pipeline. Carolina Journal has been reporting extensively on this story. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins us now with the latest update. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
First of all, recap for us, if you would, what is the fund and the project that is in question here?
Okay. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline is a major gas conduit, natural gas conduit that's going, that starts in West Virginia and eventually will flow around the down the I-95 corridor, let's say, from the state border down to Robeson County. And the purpose of this is to provide a higher volume of natural gas for potential economic development manufacturing facilities that might not have enough gas available to do these sorts of things in some of these economically distressed communities. The fund itself was set up separately from the money that any sort of large project developer sets aside to handle environmental damage or environmental restoration that's required by, you know, unearthing large amounts of land and possibly disturbing streams and things like that. In this case, the operators, who are several utilities, including Duke Energy, set aside $11 million to pay for this environmental mitigation. Now, after that was agreed to, and after that looked like everybody was ready to put pen to paper and approve the pipeline coming through North Carolina, it had gone through all the federal processes.
Because
already,
it does have to get certain permits in order,
yes,
to move forward.
It needs to get federal approval, and then it needs to get state approval. Well, after it had gone through that process, then suddenly a second fund appeared. Right around the time that the state announced that it was going to issue all of the water quality permits and the like for the pipeline to go forward. And this is the $58 million fund that's in question. What's questionable about the fund is that, it was set up outside the normal environmental mitigation process. And secondly, the way it turned out, the governor controls the money, which is raises all sorts of separation of powers and constitutional issues. According to the North Carolina Constitution, the only people who are allowed to spend money given to the state that's not designated for some other purpose, such as federal Medicaid money or food stamps or something like that, is the General Assembly. The General Assembly has to at least authorize the spending at some point, even if the General Assembly doesn't actually dole out the money. In this case, this was done entirely behind their backs. This was done by Governor Cooper, and initially it was supposed to go to his Department of Division of Environmental Quality. And as during the process of negotiations, the fund went from going to the state with Governor Cooper as the agent to going to Governor Cooper directly.
all of this that you've described, Rick, has really generated so many questions on both sides of the political aisle, including from at least one quite prominent environmental organization. What we saw happen was that the General Assembly then created a special committee to start looking into this. A few days ago, that committee held its first meeting, and the determination at that meeting was to hire an official investigator. That's a pretty serious move.
Well, it really is, because for one thing, this investigator will have subpoena power. This person will have the possibility to compel depositions or testimony potentially from people, could conceivably, you know, issue arrest warrants if it rises to that level, or at least make criminal referrals to federal officials to or state officials to, you know, issue warrants and things like that. Now, the what happened here, the reason that there's so much uproar about this, was that after the fund was announced, before any money started flowing, the General Assembly said the governor can't do this. And so the General Assembly essentially took control of the fund itself and said it was going to spend this money for to help the school systems that were going to be in the affected areas. And so some Democrats are not real happy with that. They may not be happy with the governor having the fund, but they also may not be happy with the fact that the General Assembly is taking this money. And some Republicans even weren't happy about the fact that this was going to happen, because this $57.8 million has to come from somewhere. Most likely it's going to come from ratepayers. And it looks like
people who buy electricity, you and me, anyone who's
right.
a customer of
exactly.
these utility companies involved in the pipeline.
And so the way that this fund has been described is sort of pay to play, but as if Duke Energy et al. Are going to have to pay a $57.8 million bribe, is the term that's been used, to do business in North Carolina with this pipeline. But they're not going to be paying it. We are going to be paying a bribe to do business in North Carolina, which is what has really got a lot of people upset. And then the environmental groups themselves are upset also, because they don't really think that there was necessarily adequate supervision of some of the permitting process. And they also don't think that the money should be discretionary like this, that if it's going to go if the money is supposed to go for environmental issues, it should go to environmental issues, not for other purposes, as the governor is allowed to do under this agreement.
In fact, here at the John Locke Foundation, our senior fellow, Don Vandervaart, who is a current senior fellow, the former secretary of the Department of Environmental Quality during the McCrory years, he has concerns about the timing of the permits versus this fund, even questions about the propriety of the fund itself aside, just the timing, because he's wondering, he feels like there's a possibility that the permitting process in North Carolina has been compromised.
Well, yes, because the issue is, if you are going to build a large project in the state, then of course you should be expected to make good on any damage, to make whole people who are damaged during the process. However, if in addition to that you have to pay money into funds that are discretionary, then indeed what you're essentially doing is you're saying you have to basically pay walking around money, paying bribes, in effect, to officials to do business here. Businesses aren't going to relocate in North Carolina if they feel like they're going to be shaken down by public officials just to come into the state or to expand their operations or whatever. And that's one thing that Don Vandervaart's concerned about. And then also he's concerned about, as you say, the process, because what happened during the course of this permitting was that initially a memorandum was drafted saying the money was going to go to DEQ. Number two is going to go to the state through the governor, and then number three is going to go to the governor. And they're actually – we were able to unearth through various documents. We were able to unearth the fact that at one point there were two documents presented to – or being ready to be presented to Duke Energy. One said, we'll approve the permit. One will say, we're going to deny the permit. So it's almost as if you say, sign here or you're going to lose your right to do business in this state. And that's really concerning.
So, Rick, the investigator then presumably is looking into the questions about the governor controlling the fund itself, the constitutionality of that, and how money has to be appropriated and received by the state. But then also this whole permitting question, that is a wide scope.
Well, who authorized this fund to be created? Who was involved in it? From what we can tell so far, people inside DEQ didn't have much to do with it. These looked like people inside the governor's office, possibly political appointees who were trying to do something to make the governor look good.
Now, we're going to have you back, I'm sure, a number of times as this investigation goes forward and information is released. Carolina Journal will be reporting on this, and you can read all of that at carolinajournal.com. Rick Henderson, Editor-in-Chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered, in print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Most of us shudder at speech that promotes hate. We'd like to see less hate. But how do we go about achieving that goal? Some want to ban or limit hate speech. Our next guest says that's not the answer. Nadine Strossen is professor of constitutional law at New York Law School. She's the former national president of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, and she's author of the new book, Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. Welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here, Mitch.
The title of your book sort of takes away the thunder of my first question was, well, if we're not going to censor it, what should we do? It sounds as if your message is, let's rely on free speech.
And we should rely on free speech, but we should also rely on other non-censorial measures. Let's not forget when we talk about hate, we're talking about not only hateful ideas and attitudes, which certainly can be and should be combated with more speech, including education, debate, apologies, support for the people who are disparaged, reaching out with a compassionate attitude toward those who are hateful, trying to redeem them, as has happened. But when we're talking about hateful conduct, including violent conduct, discriminatory conduct, we should punish those through anti-discrimination laws and through so-called hate crime or bias crime laws. And while we have many such laws, we don't have a full complement that I and other civil libertarians advocate. For example, in many states and at the national level of government, it is still completely lawful to actually discriminate in employment, housing, and so forth on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. That, to me, is hate or bias or discrimination in action, and we have unfinished business in making that unlawful. Likewise, here's a very controversial topic, including in your fair state of North Carolina, but voting rights. I think there are factual disagreements about the extent to which various voting laws at state and local governments are disenfranchising disproportionately certain minority groups who traditionally have been subject to hatred and discrimination, including racial minorities. To the extent that is a problem, I hope all of us would agree that laws that discriminate in voting should be reformed. So a range of measures, Mitch, that evidence has shown to be not only consistent with the First Amendment and individual liberty and democracy, but also more effective than censorship in promoting all of the values that advocates of hate speech laws champion, which I also support: equality, dignity, diversity, inclusivity, societal harmony, and individual well-being.
That is the voice of Nadine Strossen, professor of constitutional law at New York Law School, also author of this book, Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. Some of the folks listening to us, I'm guessing, will take issue with some of the things that you're talking about.
But I like that.
but all of them are dealing with actions, activity, yeah, not the speech itself. Why is it so harmful for those who say, well, hate speech is terrible. Why shouldn't we ban it? Why do we not target the speech itself?
We do not target the idea or the message or what the Supreme Court often calls the content or viewpoint of the speech. The mere fact that individuals, including the vast majority of individuals in our society or the vast majority of government officials, hate the message and consider it to be hateful or for any other reason dislike the content of speech is never a justification for censoring it. Rather, government says in that kind of situation, the remedy is more speech, not less. If, however, you go beyond the content of the speech to its context, and in a particular factual context, under all the facts and circumstances, the message, the speech, directly causes certain specific, imminent, serious harm, then the speech can and should be punished. For example, if it's targeted at an individual or small group of individuals and means to and does instill in the target a reasonable fear of being subject to violence or some other kind of harm, that is what the law recognizes as a punishable threat. And I can give you an example, Mitch, if you'd like, to show the viewpoint or content neutrality principle, which is when speech may not be punished, versus what is often called the emergency principle, when speech directly in a specific context directly causes certain harm, can be punished. Charlottesville in 2017 really illustrated both different situations. First, the mere fact that the message was deeply offensive and hateful, including "you will not replace us," "Jews will not replace us," "I am a Jew whose father was a Holocaust survivor." I'm sure that message is odious to everybody, but to those of us with that personal connection, especially so. Nonetheless, I was completely supportive of the ACLU's defense of the free speech rights of those white supremacists to utter those hateful messages, despite the horrible content. However, when later on they showed up with masked groups that were brandishing lighted torches and firearms, that to me satisfies the test of a true threat, right? Meaning to instill a reasonable fear on the part of the audience at whom it's directed that they will be subject to harm. I certainly would have felt intimidated if I were there, and that would have stopped me from even from raising my right to express my ideas.
Our time is running short, but what problem do we face if we do actually ban or censor the speech itself? What's this going to lead to that people might not be thinking about when they think, oh, banning hate speech itself, that's not going to be a problem. It's, you know, it's not a big deal.
And most people think that because they want to censor what they consider to be hate speech. And the truth is, when you look at how various kinds of speech completely across the political spectrum has been attacked as hate speech by one politician or another, by one citizens group or another, literally no speech that addresses at least any controversial issue of public policy is going to be safe. Let me just take the issue of the criminal justice system. Black Lives Matter advocacy has been attacked as hate speech. Blue Lives Matter advocacy has been attacked as hate speech. All Lives Matter advocacy has been attacked as hate speech. My favorite is on a number of campuses, advocating for free speech has been attacked as hate speech. It's inherently subjective, and that means it vests unfettered discretion in those who enforce the law. And none of us should want to hand over our own free speech rights to any lawmaker, but that should be especially true of political minorities, racial minorities, and others who are never going to wield political power.
You can learn much more by reading the book. It is titled Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. Its author is Nadine Strossen, professor of constitutional law at New York Law School. You might remember her as longtime national president of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A new state committee is looking at the treatment of college student athletes. Republican Senator Jeff Tart used the group's first meeting to question a representative of the NCAA.
You've got 19,500 teams, and you really are you have a responsibility to provide that student athlete opportunity and education, juxtaposed against approximately 100 of those 19,500 teams being the top Division I men's football program and top Division I men's basketball programs, which are the financial arm and backbone of the organization.
I think the average person who is an avid sports fan, particularly at the collegiate level, and I'm a massive capitalist conservative, so this is going to sound strange coming from me, but people talk about the salaries that the coaches, you know, if you look at most of the states, the highest paid person, state employee, is usually the head football or head basketball coach in the men's programs. But you look at, and I use John Cooper as an example, a former coach, football coach at Ohio State. He was the winningest coach in a decade, by far, in the country, and he got fired because he lost three times to Michigan in that 10-year period. How do we deal with the conflict between higher institutions of learning, the need to foster that mission, and yet we're promulgating that if these coaches don't win, they're making $2 to $5 million, they're going to disappear? How does that conflict with the mission to get the students educated and through? And you know, a lot of kids that I went through, and I'm sure it's the same that you get a lot of these big programs, they're there as a ground of preparation to become professional athletes. And we know, I love the ads where I'm going to graduate and go on to something other than what I went to school to play football for, right? How do we address that core concern and that conflict?
Scott Bearby is the NCAA's Vice President of Legal Affairs.
The NCAA's regulatory authority doesn't extend to employment on a campus. And when the association mounted an attempt many years ago, more than 20 years ago now, to address salaries of coaches, we were taken to court and we lost soundly. So employment decisions, salary decisions, those are within the purview of every campus and every board of trustees on that campus to allocate money. And that would include the hiring and firing for wins and losses and for other issues.
That's an NCAA response to State Senator Jeff Tartt. Tartt is among the North Carolina state lawmakers looking into the fair treatment of college student athletes. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A leading advocate for school choice in North Carolina has a new leader. Mike Long is now president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina, and he joins us to discuss his new role. Welcome to the job and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
So we're going to get into PEFNC and some of the things that it's working on. But first of all, tell us a little bit about your background. I understand more than three decades in education.
Well, and I'm a born and bred Tar Heel. Born in Durham, North Carolina, raised in the public schools there. Went to UNC Chapel Hill. After that, went into teaching, 7th and 8th grade social studies teacher in the Durham Public Schools. Back in the mid-80s, I developed a character education program that just blossomed all over the state and all over the country. So I traveled. I was training teachers, doing school assembly programs, working with school boards, curriculum, but about everything you can do in education. Did that for 25 years. Went into a principalship in a private school in Atlanta, and then came back to Charlotte at Carmel Christian School as head of school there. And then PEFNC gave a call and said, you know, all those 30 years of experience in education might help us kind of take our organization to a whole new level because school choice is truly on a roll, and North Carolina is one of the leading advocates of it across the country.
So as you've described it, you've had a role in the public schools and in private schools. What is it about this school choice movement that tells you this is what I should be doing now?
My wife and I raised our two children in the Durham public school system in elementary school. And then we found that there were other needs in other areas that we felt they could benefit. We had the opportunity, we had the means to put our children in a private school that helped meet their educational needs, and they thrived. My goal, my heart now is for all North Carolina families to have that very same opportunity.
You mentioned that your previous job before this was working at a private school.
Yes.
In that role, did you work much with PEFNC? And if so, what was your impression of it?
Yes, we had students who came to our schools who were benefiting from the opportunity scholarships that are provided by the state of North Carolina. We had students who came to our schools because of scholarships from the disability, children with learning disabilities, because we were able to meet those special needs of those children. And to see the faces of moms and dads coming in the door, seeing where here is an opportunity for our child to thrive, where in reality they weren't able to thrive because they were forced to go to a school because of a zip code they lived in. And so that to me was really special. It touched my heart to see those kids grow, graduate, go to college, the success that they had. The more I learned about PEFNC and what they do to help promote that throughout the state was just, like I said, very, very encouraging to me. And I jumped on the opportunity when it came to help lead that.
That is the voice of Mike Long. He is the president of PEFNC, which is Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina. So as you worked with PEFNC in your previous role, were there things that you said to yourself, hey, you know, I wish this group would be able to tackle this too, and now you're going to have an opportunity to do that?
Yeah, I think one of the strengths of our organization is our parent liaison program. We have parent liaisons in different areas of the state that are directing parents, first of all, how to apply for the scholarships, walk them through the scholarships, point them to the school that will best meet their need. We want to grow that. I would like to see a parent liaison in all 100 counties, each of our 100 counties throughout the state. The other thing I'd like to see us do moving forward is to create an opportunity to hold our schools accountable. And I don't mean just public schools. I also mean the private schools, the charter schools, home schools. How do we hold them accountable in their success or their failure all the way across the board? I do want our families to understand we are not at all against traditional public schools. We are all for them, as a matter of fact. We just want to help them get better, and we can do that by working with all of the other opportunities in schools as well.
One of the things I've often heard from people who are big advocates of school choice is just what you were talking about, the fact that the more choice you have, it doesn't mean an attack on the public schools. It means another opportunity to force them to get better because they're competing for students.
Yeah, I just came from a private school here in Raleigh where I observed what they were doing there. And one of the things that really impressed me was one room that is devoted to purely character education, values, you know, the values of respect, responsibility, maturity, discipline, character, you know, the core values that all of us as parents and grandparents want for our children and our grandchildren. I thought, what a tremendous idea and what a difference it's making in that school and how these kids learn, how they respect one another, how it raises the bar, the safety element that's there. This is something that we can also take into other schools that do not do this to help them get better. And this, and especially when this is what parents want. If there's one thing I learned about character, this is not a liberal conservative. It's not a Republican Democrat debate. And that's another thing that really encouraged me about this organization and the way that it reaches across the aisle and brings people together in a climate of political divisiveness as never seen in our country. The school choice movement is one that brings people together, and it's because we are focusing on the needs of our children.
You're new to the job, so I suspect that one of your biggest challenges is learning about the organization, what it does, what it should do. But what do you see as some of the biggest challenges overall for school choice?
Well, I think for one, the argument of, well, you're taking dollars away from the public school system. Well, from what I've learned so far, no, we're not. There are so many dollars that go into public schools. It's just absolutely incredible. And I've seen North Carolina now take a lead in bringing teacher salaries back to a par of where they need to be nationally. I've seen them reducing class size, and I've seen them doing all kinds of things to help the traditional public schools with the funds that they offer. When you have 1.5 million of our children in the state in traditional public schools, and you have another million or so that are doing other things, that is significant. And we as leaders in government, we as educators, I think we need to listen to our customer base and what our customers are looking for and meet the needs of all of them. So, no, we're not taking money away from public schools. We are adding to that customer base of support and letting them make the decision on what to do with those monies.
In the brief amount of time that we have left, what do you expect to see coming out of PEF&C in the next few weeks or months? What's going to be the top priority?
Well, the top priority will be to grow our Parent Liaison program so that any parent who wants to look into these scholarship opportunities, they can go to pefnc.org and they can get with our parent liaisons that we currently have to walk them through that. I'd like to see that grow. I'd like to see one in every county of the state. And then on the other end, I would like to bring in a bipartisan, a full coalition of different school opportunities where we bring people from charter to homeschool to public school to private school to Christian schools, bring them together to form a coalition of accountability for all of our schools so that we know what really defines success, what really defines failure, what we can look at where schools are not working well and help them improve. That is one of my number one priorities as I come now into this organization.
That is the voice of Mike Long. He is the new president of Parents for Educational Freedom in North Carolina, or PEFNC. The website, as you heard, pefnc.org. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Voters have spoken in North Carolina. How can you make sense of what they said about the legislature, Congress, the courts, the Constitution? Carolina Journal has you covered. In print each month, online every day. Carolina Journal is your source for up-to-the-minute information about North Carolina state government policies and their impact on you. Carolina Journal offers in-depth analysis of the election's aftermath, then looks ahead to 2019. How will elections affect your family, your wallet, your schools, your business? Find out in the free Carolina Journal newspaper, online at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, your number one source for government news that affects you. Visit carolinajournal.com today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Millennials are now stepping outside traditional health insurance for medical care. And instead, this group is choosing things like urgent care, retail clinics, telemedicine, and something called direct primary care. Our next guest writes that this on-demand mentality from millennials could markedly change the primary care sector of healthcare. Jordan Roberts is healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's been writing about this at johnlocke.org, and he joins us now. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
So when we think of on-demand, I think of buying things online and having a box show up on my doorstep, or Netflix or another streaming service. I want to binge watch House of Cards, something like that. But I hadn't heard of it in healthcare until you wrote about it.
Right. So what we're seeing now is that the traditional health insurance model is just really not as attractive to younger people and really a wide range of people now, and that they really aren't going to the traditional primary care doctor for all of their services, and that they're going to these other more readily accessible facilities to get some of the preventative services that primary care doctors can do. And what this does is really gives them the convenience to get these services whenever they want, and it really takes out the insurance mess out of it, all the billing and processes that come with having health insurance.
This is so different from the traditional way of receiving health care, because I can remember back on my first job out of college, and I had my first official health insurance plan that was all mine. And the first thing they told me is you must choose a primary care doctor,
right.
And that's the person that you go to, that you call whenever anything is wrong. And we are just really moving away from that to wanting it to be, I guess, more convenient.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, the primary care doctor is so important, establishing that relationship. But that's just not really the status quo anymore. And, you know, what we're seeing is that these services that can be traditionally done at primary care doctors can be done at a wide range of places now. And so there's a slew of other options to get these services. They're a lot cheaper and a lot more accessible to a wide range of the population.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of those options that millennials are choosing more frequently now. Urgent care.
That's right. So this is kind of, I would describe this in between the emergency room and your primary care doctor. So you would go to the emergency room for life-threatening things that need to be treated right now, conditions that need to be treated immediately. But the urgent care address some of these issues, not all of them, but some of them, and it really takes away that costly emergency room setting that you get a lot of the care from. We see an emergency room visits on the rise lately, and you can directly link a lot of high hospital costs to the emergency room care. So urgent care gives you another option, like I said, in between your primary care doctor and the emergency room to get some of these services taken care of that you don't need the emergency room for.
Retail clinics also becoming more and more popular.
That's right.
Where do they fit in the mix here?
So these are in the name, retail clinics. These are clinics and facilities that are at retail stores like CVS and things like that. So whenever you're doing some shopping, you can get shots, get small things looked at, and this really provides the convenience of being in places that are not the primary care doctor's office, and it really gives you a cheap option to get a lot of these things done that you don't need to go to the primary care doctor for. So these are popping up all over, and what we see a lot of times is businesses are now employing a retail clinic facility in their company's property now. So you can have a direct clinician there to see the employees and give them care on site.
How do these two work in terms of payment, Jordan? Urgent care and retail clinics. Is insurance involved here?
Not at all. So what happens is they post their prices for all of these services. And so you know up front what you're paying for and what that gets you. And there's a lot of price transparency, and people really like to know up front that they can get a certain service for X amount of dollars and know where to get it.
And that becomes a really key factor when we talk about reforming healthcare to try to expand access and lower costs. Because
absolutely.
I have to admit, you know, if I go to the doctor, I don't know what the true cost, the behind-the-scenes cost is of the service I'm receiving.
Exactly.
I just know my copay, my deductible.
Right. So, you know, if we can get a lot of those prices out in front of the eyes of consumers, then we can really, you know, make some leeway into instilling some market initiatives into healthcare more generally.
So those two things, retail clinics and urgent care, folks listening to us who maybe are not millennials may have actually accessed those too, because they're pretty visible out and about.
Mm-hmm.
The other two that you wrote about, I think, might be a little bit more of a mystery to some
That's
people.
Right.
First of all, let's talk about telemedicine. What is it?
Telemedicine. So this is any type of healthcare that you get electronically through any sort of digital source, and that can be over the phone, store and forward pictures and different videos that are providing knowledge about different conditions or anything, or seeing a doctor right through, you know, a video conferencing sort of setting. So this is where you can remotely get services through any type of technology. And the reason that this is becoming so important in our healthcare delivery is that it's so easy and so accessible. And these are, again, talking about services that can be done in a primary care doctor's offices that are now being brought to the patient. Telemedicine, if you have a rash or a cold, something like this, instead of waiting in line at the doctor's office, you can hop on your phone, almost instantly speak directly with a doctor for fairly low price and get that same service with taking traditional insurance in the primary care doctor's completely out of the equation.
So now instead of having to call for an appointment, travel over to the doctor's office, I can take a picture of the weird thing growing on my arm, text it to my doctor and say, what is this?
Instant answers. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Then there's something called direct primary care. Help mm-hmm. us understand exactly how this works.
Sure. So direct primary care, it's probably the closest substitute for primary care that I wrote about in this piece. And what this is it's a sort of like a gym membership. You pay a monthly fee and you get around-the-clock access to your primary care doctor. Almost all of the ailments that you could have, the primary care doctor can take care of. You can get prescription drugs, and it completely takes insurance out of the question. The direct primary care doctor spends zero time on insurance paperwork, figuring out how to get reimbursed and complying with all the regulations that are put forth on them. And it really allows the key focus of healthcare to allow the doctor to spend as much time with the patient as they can. And people, physicians and patients really enjoy that personalized relationship that you get with direct primary care. And like I said, no health insurance, one flat monthly rate.
Does that mean then that I just don't have health insurance at all, or is this in addition to? How does that work?
So in a lot of cases, it means that you don't have health insurance at all, and that's allowed now under some new federal laws. But a lot of times what happens with direct primary care is you get a supplemental wraparound insurance, a high deductible plan that protects you in the case of some catastrophic event. But all your other primary care services, all this, the day-to-day stuff, can be done at the direct primary care physician's office.
So you would have a lower health insurance premium because you had a higher deductible.
That's
because
right.
Because you only want that policy to cover you if the worst happens.
Exactly. That
and
catastrophic
for the regular
care.
Stuff, like the oil changes for the car,
exactly.
Then you use your direct primary care.
That's right.
We've been talking with Jordan Roberts. He is healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you.
Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
This week's edition of Carolina Journal Radio is brought to you by Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, working every day to transform the health system for North Carolinians. More information available at todaywe.com.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.